picking up a copy of The Mirror and then hopping on the red 3rd Avenue streetcar and riding it to the Grand Central Palace? If you do recall all those New York institutions, well then, dearie, you're much older than I. In those days, New York was the center of big-time network radio. Ever since the 1920s, the metropolitan area has been the home of a large number and wide variety of AM radio stations. And in their book, The Airwaves of New York, Bill Jaker, Frank Sulik, and Peter Kanz trace the history of 156 AM stations from WAAM, one of the most important stations in the early days of New York radio, all the way down to WNYC, the prototype for public broadcasting throughout the country. The book is published by McFarland & Company, and I'm delighted that it brings Messrs. Jaker, Sulik, and Kanz to New York & Company today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
And all of you guys worked in radio at one time or another and fell in love with it?
We still are.
Still are.
We're in love with it more and more since we wrote the book, aren't we?
Well, one of you works in TV these days, defected to the enemy.
No, I work in TV, but then that makes radio even more fascinating, you know, because I can remember when radio was really at the center of a household, and the whole family gathered around it for hours every day. And it's become a more personal medium right now, but it's got a great history, which we've finally been able to get down. This is the first time anybody has written the entire comprehensive history of radio, just AM, 156 AM stations in the New York metropolitan area.
Should point out, you're Bill Jaker, right?
Yes.
Why don't you just identify yourself so people will recognize your voice?
I am Peter Kanz.
And I'm Frank Sulik.
Now, of course, radio and television are pretty much the same thing. They serve the same function in a lot of ways, don't they? But also, AM is pretty much the history of radio until just 30 years ago. And most people aren't aware of how far back radio goes. You say that the 19th century already had radio.
The first demonstration of wireless was by Marconi himself in 1899, came in to send reports of the America's Cup yacht race for the New York Herald. The first major broadcast that anybody can consider to be a really serious broadcast was on a temporary station called WJY. It was set up by RCA and covered the Dempsey-Carpentier fight in July of 1921. And then the first permanent station was WJZ, which was originally a Westinghouse station. And they premiered in September, October of 21, doing the World Series. So the first programs ever in New York radio were all sportscasts.
And was New York then the first station, I mean, the first city to have a lot of stations? Because when I was a kid, I remember shows coming from all over. Even if New York was the main place, Lone Ranger came from Detroit. Didn't it?
I think by 1922, New York probably took the lead among cities with stations. 1921, it was still formulative.
Yeah, by the late 20s, the dial was totally overpopulated. The stations was popping up everywhere. Chicago actually had a couple of more stations than we did, but you add in the suburban areas. We have more stations than we knew what to do with.
And we were also the home of the networks.
Right, and of course, educational institutions had an early part and a large part in developing drama and entertainment workshops.
Hmm. You mean Columbia University and
I was thinking of WHAZ at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy,
New York.
Though
oddly, none of the universities, colleges in New York had a station, nor did any of the newspapers in the early days have a station, though, of course, the city of New York had its own radio station there was a police radio called WLAW, and
LAW? That's great.
And they were right on the broadcast.
Sounds like
then
a cable station now.
Well, it was like a police scanner, and the police were a little uncomfortable about their messages being heard. But the city decided that it would go into the broadcasting business, and even though there was some reluctance to license a municipal entity like New York City, they did get a station, and they built it right in the same building on the same floor that we are right now.
The other part of this floor.
Yeah.
These studios went into operation, I think, around 1986.
Mm-hmm. WNYC also had the distinction of having the first announcer on the air, who was on the air. Tommy Cowan began at WJZ when they began.
First
began at WNYC when it began.
Yeah, he was first radio announcer in New York City.
The person who said coming up next or whatever?
Yes, Tommy Cowan, Tommy who was Cowan with the station till about when, I
60,
suppose?
I think he died in the late 1960s.
Yeah, so he was there a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, WNYC was first I guess, proposed in 24, but didn't go on the air until 28, which means it was started before the BBC, but went on after the BBC. So those are the two first public radio stations. After that, were they all over the country?
WRR in Dallas, I believe, was a little bit earlier.
Yeah, there were a couple of other municipal stations, but the really funny thing about this station is that it was originally at 570 on the dial, and a 1928 WMCA, which was at 810, displaced WNYC. The man who ran WMCA, Donald Flam, who incidentally died just earlier this year at the age of 99, very well connected politically, very well connected to Tammany Hall. He worked out a time-sharing arrangement on WNYC's frequency at 570, and although the station protested vigorously and, in fact, fought it to the Supreme Court, they were moved down to WMCA's old frequency of 810.
Mm-hmm. And which is where we were until recently.
Which is, yeah, so that's why we're at the spot on the dial.
And one of the reasons given for taking us away from the better frequency was that the city was being used for political purposes. The station, the mayor at the time, was using it to promote his own career. And yet, our greatest memory of WNYC is when Mayor LaGuardia went on and read the funnies and all of that. That was a political act, wasn't it?
Well, it was one of the most unique off-the-cuff ad-lib series ever.
Yeah, he had a weekly program, Sunday at Noon, which was the top-rated program in its time period, and in 1945, it actually won a Peabody Award. And it was only after winning that award that there was a strike of newspaper truck drivers, and so LaGuardia uses airtime to read the funnies.
I think in terms of the use of the medium, use of radio, Bill, it ranks almost as high as FDR's Fireside Chats.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun for me to go through this book and look at all the different call letters, because there are an awful lot that were around when I was a kid that are no longer with us. There were different stations, different call letters for the same, I guess, the same ownership or the same spots on the dial. But was there a certain amount of stability from the early days until the 60s or so, when radio went into its next major period of turmoil?
Well, WOR continues to have the same call letters when they signed on in 1921, 22.
But you mentioned Jay-Z.
WJZ is now WABC.
We had WMGM for a while.
WMGM was WHN,
mm-hmm.
and became WMGM, and then went back to WHN, at which point it became WUKQ for briefly, and then became WEVD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course there was there's a WBBR now. It's Bloomberg Business Radio. There was an earlier station with the same call letters, no relation. It was owned by Jehovah's Witnesses.
Watchtower Bible Brooklyn.
Yes.
So it was Bible Brooklyn Radio.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In those days, you could probably get call letters that reflected what you wanted. Now you get any call letters they give you, and then you try to come up with a slogan to match.
You're running out of letters, I think.
Well, they don't even give you call letters at this point. You request what you want, and if they're not already been assigned, then you may have them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fascinating things that we discovered in the airwaves of New York is, you might say, the genealogy of some of the stations. There used to be a station in Brooklyn called WCNW. That had a very good following in the African-American community. It was sold in 1941, and a man named Elias Godofsky reestablished it with the new call letters WLIB. Mm-hmm. Ran it as WLIB for a few years, sold it to the New York Post. He used to own WLIB. Godofsky took the money, some of that money, started a new station at Hempstead, Long Island, called WHLI, mm-hmm. which is sort of the quintessential suburban station now. But
this guy's an inventor of formats.
Yeah, and WHLI and WLIB are, if not sister stations, at least first cousins.
And when you think of where the Post is today, Rupert Murdoch could possibly be the owner of WLIB, which is an impossible situation.
WLIB had the distinction of being the first commercial competition for WQXR in classical music.
Yeah, originally it was a classical music station.
People don't know that. A lot of people don't know that. And, of course, WNYC was a big force in classical music at the time, too.
Mm-hmm, because we were broadcasting concerts live. The Masterwork Hour was probably the most imitated classical format in the country.
One of the oldest.
Now, how soon did the kinds of formats that we're used to come into being? The DJ is fairly early, isn't it? All news?
Well, the DJ started with in New York with a fellow named Martin Block,
Oh, he was around when I was around.
And there were some arguments as to whether he took the concept from a West Coast guy named Al Jarvis.
Mm-hmm.
So who started what when is up to, I guess, depending on if you were a New Yorker or if you were from Los Angeles.
And how late was that development?
1935, I believe, was when Martin Block came to New York, about 1935.
Talk shows start around 1935 as well?
Talk shows started at the very beginning.
But the whole idea, like Pagin and Ed and shows like that...
Yeah, they weren't so freewheeling in the early days. I think that was the big change, and maybe, I don't know...
Al and Dora McCann were on WGL, which became WOV and is now WADO, and WGL was around from 1927 to 28.
Uh-huh. So they were doing that sort of thing fairly early. All the formats that we know today have their... originate in the earliest days?
Well, there was a little station in Jamaica, in Queens, southeast Queens, near where I grew up, as a matter of fact, called WMRJ, that was on the late 20s, early 30s, had a guy on there named John J. Anthony, who would give a device on the radio. People would call up and tell him their problems.
The advice man, John J. Anthony.
Yes.
He talked like that, if I remember.
No names, please.
No names, please.
I think we'll find that the advent of the format itself was a result of network programs going to television and the need for a personalized medium, as you mentioned before, Bill.
Yeah.
As radio was losing out as the big power... as we lost all of those great sitcoms drama shows to television, it had to get more and more personal.
It did, and it was more one-on-one, more of the one person behind the microphone speaking to that one person of many people in the audience.
Yeah, I don't know if my partners in this book would totally agree with me on this, but it seems to me that the network, the big major network stations, WNBC, WCBS, WJZ, really were at a loss when they lost their network flagship status. These were major production centers, and NBC, of course, eventually went under. The 660 spot was taken over in WFAN, but WABC also had some lean years. I don't know, Pete, would you agree with that?
What saved WABC was rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a top 40 station for many years.
It was a top 40 station for many years, but from the period from maybe the mid-50s to 1960, when the rock and roll format started, it was a melange of Ernie Kovacs in the morning and Herb Oscar Anderson singing with big bands in the midday and Hal Kemp. And
the Metropolitan Opera on Saturday.
And the Metropolitan Opera, and Don McNeil, and
Breakfast Club.
Good Morning Breakfast Clubbers, and I don't think anybody really knew what to do with it. You know, keep it busy until we decide what we want to do.
Can you imagine a program director coming up with a lineup like that today? He'd be fired in 10 seconds.
Well, WNBC.
Everybody wants the same consistent sound throughout the day.
WNBC had no idea what to do with 660 from probably the mid-60s on. You look at the number of formats, the number of people who came and went. They achieved some success in the mid-1960s when they pioneered the talk format, the talk back with listeners type format. But after 1978, when the man who came into New York to show New York how to do radio, a guy named Bob Pittman, fired Don Imus.
That
was a smart move. And interestingly enough, the person who replaced Don Imus was Bob Pittman's girlfriend at the time, a woman named Ellie Dillon. And it might be prophetic because the first time that Ellie Dillon opened her mouth at 6:07 on that morning coming out of the 6 o'clock news, she flubbed the opening frame. She flubbed her lines.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
I think the earliest exponent of talk radio is WOR. That led into the phone format that we have today.
There was an engineer named Russell Tinklepaw, I think it's a great name, who devised the tape delay device that actually made talk radio possible.
But they had, OR had all the great people. Henry Morgan used to work there.
Gene Shepard.
The Gamblings, John A. and B. and R., or B. A. and R., actually. In that
I remember those by the word bar.
And, of course, Bob and Ray, when you talk of B. and R.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And listening to them in the morning was a thrill when I was a kid. We have to go to a break, but I'm getting the feeling that you're saying that radio started off decentralized as local stations developed, and then for a time it became quite centralized, New York as the center, perhaps L.A. as an alternative provider. And then it became decentralized again, at least AM radio. And perhaps the decentralization the second time was because of FM coming along and changing the whole thing even more important in changing the way AM radio functioned than TV coming along.
And a lot of the talent blossomed in L.A. and Chicago locally after those centralized days.
Yeah, well, of course, what you would find is, in the early days, every station doing its own production, having live music, they would have dramatic programs sometimes, and all of the stations on the air, even the very smallest, did have that production capability. So that's something that could always be brought back, of course, but it was there in the early days.
My guests on New York & Company are Bill Jaker, Frank Sulik, and Peter Kanz. They've written a book called The Airwaves of New York. It's got lots of pictures as well, and it provides illustrated histories of 156 AM stations in the metropolitan area from 1921 to just 2 years ago, 1956. It's published by McFarland. And we'll be taking your calls at 212-267-WNYC right after this.
WNYC is supported by Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, for 6 years independently ranked as the number one cancer center, pioneering procedures that go beyond saving a life to saving the quality of life. Information on seeing their cancer specialists, 800-525-2225. Memorial Sloan Kettering, the best cancer care anywhere.
I'm Ira Glass. Join writers Sarah Val, Dan Savage, David Rakoff, and me at Town Hall on Sunday, December 13th, for a rare live taping of This American Life. But you know, if you do not call soon for tickets, the box office guy will only be able to do for you what he did for this listener.
He put his arms around me and he just held me. And he said to me, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry I can't do that for you anymore."
Don't get sold out. Call Ticketmaster 212-307-4100.
Take as many calls as we can for my guests Bill Jaker, Frank Sulik, and Peter Kanz. Their book, The Airwaves of New York, is published by McFarland. And Willie from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
This is not Willie from Brooklyn.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to put you on hold because your phone is feeding back, and we'll go to somebody who is one of those people who really was important in the history of radio and a personal friend, Gene Bach. Hi, Gene.
Well, how do you do indeed? I think your guests ought to tackle Chicago next. It's a note of civic pride, but honestly, everything originated out there.
And actually, we're working on Butte, Montana next.
No, come on. Listen, the disc jockey started in Chicago, and I never hear it mentioned. A guy named Bob Hawk had a show Red Hot and Blue, and I remember hearing it. We all know how old I am because I'm making a big point of it these days, but actually 1933. And I remember his theme song was Clyde McCoy, Sugar Blues, and he was on every day. Mm. WCFL.
Oh, yeah. So the Voice of Labor.
And Van Zorgen.
Well, you see, you are up on that. But, I mean, when you think of the Easy Aces and Vic and Save, well, Vic and Save wasn't all that big, but Fibber McGee and Molly, there were loads of shows, all kids shows out of Chicago.
So Fibber McGee and Molly was the most popular show in America for a while, wasn't it?
It was one of the most popular.
Where was Amos and Andy broadcast?
Well, originally from Chicago. They were moved to L.A.
Chicago, yeah. They
were Gene, you're making a case for Chicago being the most important radio city in America.
Well, you know why that was? Because early in the
history...
had
nothing else to do.
No, in the history of network radio, the sponsors would be charged line fees for their network programs, and it was cheaper to feed them from the center of the country. As soon as they took the line fees out of the bill... then things moved to New York and L.A.
Well, that's very, very interesting. That part I didn't know. And I just thought it was native Chicago brilliance. But
Well, you came here anyway, Gene, and we appreciate that.
I'll come here eventually.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I don't know. Oops, what happened to that? Okay. Hi, you're on the air? Are you there? Okay.
That's why radio works in the early days. You call them.
Hi, this is Beauvais.
Yes, it is. I think way back when they had Travis Timetable in the senior edition, I was over there a bit occasionally. What I was going to ask about, as I recall, the high-powered station back about 1923 would be maybe 500 watts, and the KDKA was an achievement if you got it.
Yeah, what was the power of the early stations?
Well,
I think 1,000 watts was pretty powerful for a station in the early 20s.
Yeah, in the mid-20s, WJZ went to 50,000 watts, but they were blotting out everything in central New Jersey, and they had them cut back their power for a long time. So the real high-power stations, I don't think, came in until maybe the late 20s.
And, of course, the late 30s brought off 500,000 watts from WLW.
Yeah, there was one station in this country that was 500,000 watts, and that didn't last.
But that was...
WLW, the nation station in Cincinnati.
But the whole idea at one point was to have certain stations that would be able to broadcast at greater power and reach across states, because before networks were created, there was a feeling that we had to do something in case of emergency, have some station that could cover as many different states as possible.
The clear channels.
And they're still around, even though there's no need for them. WOR, ABC are clear channels, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
WOR is Class 1B, I believe.
Which, you know, had the first directional antenna so that they were concentrating their signal. But prior to about 1927, people would listen to the radio much the way they surf the net today, just seeing what they could pick up. And after the networks began, they stopped listening to stations, began listening to programs, and that's where the networks became dominant.
And then when certain programs came on, like Amos and Andy, and all work stopped in this country, you knew just how powerful radio had become.
Yeah, though you don't have to stop what you're doing to listen to radio. That's great thing about it.
In fact, you don't even have to listen. Just keep it on in the background. Frank from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Oh, boy. What a subject this is. The radio has been my life from as a child listening to Joe Penner on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And Omar the Mystic, which really blew my mind.
What station was Omar the Mystic on?
I don't know.
I think it was on WOR Mutual.
Almost everything was on WOR.
yeah.
Well, they were the dominant station for a long time. Still are in the top five regularly in ratings.
Their music was Scheherazade. And then during the war, we had Gloom Dodgers on WEVD.
WHN also. The Gloom Dodgers with Phil Goulding.
It was 4 hours in the morning with Maury Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. He was great.
He took over after Henry Morgan went to war. And they had... oh my God! What are they? Those sisters, those wonderful sisters.
Barry sisters.
Which what?
Barry sisters.
Barry sisters. They were great. Maury Amsterdam sang his songs
and played the cello.
Kay Stevens, I believe.
I think those were the greatest days he ever had, and of course the greatest program of all time. Ginny Bach just mentioned Vic and Sade.
Yeah, that's a great.
I have discovered in my adult years was better than I thought it was as a child.
I'm sorry. When you listen to some of the old shows, are you surprised? Do they sound just as good today as they did in the past?
Some are dated, some are not. I still find Fred Allen very funny, but then I'm aware of the history of that period, so I can catch all the topical jokes. Jack Benny has held up pretty well. I think Henry Morgan holds up pretty well listening to it again.
Because wit is wit.
Yes. And something like Vic and Sade, which is a soap opera out of Chicago, it was on both CBS and NBC at the same time, is almost surrealistic. So it's a very,
like
very
Crazy Cat.
Oh,
it'll
yes.
hold up as long as Shakespeare is held up, we can safely say.
Let's take one more call. Jerry from Flushing, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. I remember as a kid, every Sunday morning... and our family were about as religious as squids, but my father would put the Mormon Tabernacle Choir on.
Oh, yeah.
And there were programs that were so enjoyable, but today I believe would be politically incorrect, such as Life with Luigi, Beulah.
Even more so, the Johnson Brothers. That one has largely been forgotten. Do you ever hear the Johnson,
Family.
Johnson Family.
Yes, it was one man doing all the voices.
The most racist program I've ever heard in my life, and yet it was a national show.
Yeah. You know what I also enjoyed was The Weed of Crime Bears Bitter Fruit, The Shadow Knows.
You know, that sounds so good on the phone, the way you say that. You really sound like...
Orson Welles. Yes, you do. Sure. You sound just like Orson Welles.
By the way, he only did that for a year. There were people who did it much longer than he.
Bill Johnstone later.
But there was some beautiful music, though, also. And
Jerry,
was fun. One last thing. My dad used to drive me to school. And he always had, even though they were politically... and the antithesis of my father's own politics, He always used to listen to Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick.
And you talked about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. It had the distinction when it went off of being the longest-running weekly network radio program in the free world.
Wow.
Well, now it's going to be Lawrence Welk on public television, isn't it? He mentioned the Barry Sisters and also Life with Luigi. Radio was quite ethnic in those days. The Barry Sisters also appeared on shows on WEVD, I think it was, that mm-hmm. were aimed at a Jewish audience, where I remember hearing some of those shows where I'd be going along with a joke and then the punchline would be in Yiddish and nobody, I wouldn't understand what was being said, and my parents would laugh. And the Barry Sisters were regular, Jan Bart, people like that. There were shows aimed at blacks in a way that are quite different than today.
One of the great things about New York radio is that because there were so many stations, such a diverse audience, that what today would be called niche programming, ethnic programming, started very, very early. And, you know, there have been like 50, 60 different radio stations on the air. WCNW in Brooklyn was broadcasting in Chinese in the 30s. WOV was a great Italian language station, also had some of the best jazz programming in the city. That was what might be called alternative radio today, but after they do their slogan was Italian all day, jazz all night. Mm-hmm. And they'd get done with Aldo Aldi or whoever was on during the day. And so Fred Robbins would come on and play jazz records. And country and western also, I think.
William B. Williams first got popular on WOV. WOV, as it was known.
By Fred Robbins to the
today,
WOV people.
Can we say today that AM radio is pretty much all talk? That music has deserted to FM?
Well, I think it's partially just because of audio. That the
it worked
audio,
okay in the past. People didn't mind listening to music on AM for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the last station, we have 156 stations we tell about in alphabetical order in this book. But, Peter, the last station book is WZRC, which came on just a couple of years ago, just by coincidence, one of the newer stations.
WZRC started out as life as WHOM, which was also a famous ethnic mm-hmm. radio station. Mm-hmm. And WZRC at that point was K-Rock, WXRK, which was WHOM-FM in a previous incarnation. And in WZRC's incarnation, it was a heavy metal rock and roll satellite radio station that was done out of Dallas. And the problem with the signal was that you couldn't get it outside of a five-block area around the transmitter.
Which is very good when you're talking about heavy metal music.
I don't know. I like that. I like that genre. I program that on my own radio station. But
people weren't sure whether it was static or music.
The only way that they could sell the format to national sponsors was that they paid the owners of K-Rock to use that frequency so they could sell advertising time around the country, saying that, okay, you will be aired in New York. What mm-hmm. they didn't tell the Chicago people was that you will be heard in New York, literally, between blocks 42 and 57, from 3rd Avenue to 6th Avenue. The less you know, the better you are.
And I think there was a last attempt at a music station actually coming onto the AM band and coming on fresh like that.
I think WWRL, if you want to count the return to urban, adult urban music.
Probably.
And, of course, the old QXR, which is now QEW, is playing Frank Sinatra and big bands and things like that. Hmm. So there's a little bit of music on AM, but pretty much all of it is talk and news.
Yeah, and you have a different signal pattern also if I go to the technical stuff, but usually AM stations are going to carry a little bit further on the AM side than you will sometimes on FM.
And we're grateful that our signal is carrying further than it used to, 10,000 watts now.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you guys a lot for being on our show, Bill Jaker, Frank Sulik, and Peter Kanz. Their book, The Airwaves of New York, Illustrated Histories of 156 AM Stations in the Metropolitan Area from 1921 to 1996. If you have any fond memories of New York radio in the old days, up through just 2 years ago, this is the book for you with lots of pictures. And thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.